Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me to share with you some of the ideas I have about soft computing and analytics. Today we have heard quite a number of technical talks, so that's why I decided that tonight we will not be too technical. We're only going to touch upon some of the technicalities, but mainly this is going to be a story about how to use this technology, how to use these methods in order to solve actual real-world problems with industry. So I'm bringing up a number of cases where we have been using these techniques, where we have learned a number of things about how to use soft computing methods. In the abstract, it was mentioned real options and portfolios of real options. Now we have some newer data, so I actually thought that that might make more sense because most of you have an engineering background, so I like to introduce some of the engineering applications. Current problem that we have to face is the big data issues. And the big data is something which has happened now over the last 5 to 7 years. And big data offers a challenge because idea here is that it is a challenge to cope with the huge amounts of data that we now produce with information technology. But as Harvard Business Review has it, it is also a possibility for companies, for industry, if they can actually manage to master the possibilities that we have in the big data. It is actually one of the definitions here. It's a collection of data sets so large and complex that it becomes difficult to process using on-hand database management tools or traditional data processing applications. So there are, of course, a number of definitions about big data, but I think this is the most practical one. As of last year, the limits on the size of data sets that are feasible to process in a reasonable amount of time, now you see all the qualifications here, a reasonable amount of time are in the order of exabytes of data. So that's where we put the limit for big data last year. This is actually affecting everything we do with the internet search. It's affecting finance and business informatics. And data sets are actually growing in size all the time. We encounter this problem in industry applications. We see that there are now a number of things producing data that have not been around before. Like mobile devices, we have aerial sensory technologies, we have software logs, we have cameras, we have microphones, we have radio frequency identification readers, and we have wireless sensor networks. So all of these produce data that we should actually be able to use for various purposes. Here is one of the numbers. The per capita capacity to store information has roughly doubled every 40 months since the 1980s. As of 2012, every day, 2.5 quintillion, that's 2.5 times 10 to the power 18 bytes of data were created. And it's difficult to work with it, and we have seen now that technology tries to cope by introducing new ways to process the data. We have the massively parallel software running on tens, hundreds, and thousands of servers. So you split it up, and then you actually increase the volume of processing capacity. You use the so-called raw power of massive parallel systems. So this is one answer. There are several other answers I'm going to go into, but have a look at Perl, which is the editing robots of Wikipedia. Perl has to deal with terabytes of data, and there is the NASA Center for Climate Simulations. This is an integrated set of supercomputing, visualization, and data integration technologies focused on weather and climate prediction, stores up to 32 petabytes of climate observations and simulations on the Discover supercomputing cluster per day. Per day. This is done with the latest 15,000 processor Discover supercomputer, which can perform 160 trillion operations per second. A petabyte 10 to the power 15 is equal to the amount of data in all US academic research libraries. So this gives some idea about the volumes we are talking about when we talk about big data. This is what it looks like when the Perl robot is editing Wikipedia. If there's a change to one of the entries in Wikipedia, that has an effect on a number of other entries. As you remember, there is more than 1 million articles in Wikipedia. So if we would do that manually, we would have a task ahead of us which would not be very nice to carry out. So that's why we create these robots to carry out that work for us. And here is then part of the answer. We try to go with intelligent technologies, which is capable of doing the massive work for us in a much shorter time than we could accomplish ourselves, and doing this tirelessly 24 hours per day, 7 days per week, and without interruption, without any trade union noise about having to do too much work. So that was Perl. And this is a graphical representation of where the Perl is moving in order to do the editing in Wikipedia. Analytics is now a new movement. Analytics is actually what we have been talking about. Those of us who are operations researchers, please raise a hand if you feel like operations researchers. Am I the only operations researcher here? I don't believe you. Analytics is now the modern version of operations research, means that the methods that we developed in operations research is now supported with the software to such an extent that we don't have to do too much of the mathematics by hand anymore. This analytics is focused on business data, and it's used to describe, predict, and improve business performance. So now you see the focus for analytics was actually business-oriented from the very beginning. Now it's, of course, branching out, doing lots of other things. But the selling point was that here we have methods for decision management, for retail analytics, for store assortment, marketing optimization, marketing mix analytics, web analytics, sales force sizing and optimization, price and promotion modeling, predictive science, credit risk analysis, and fraud analytics. So as you can see, this already spread out to lots of application areas, all of these requiring good algorithmic tools at the core of these methods. Here is Google. Google is, of course, reporting on everything happening on Google sites. So if you are a paying customer of Google, they can very quickly collect all kinds of analytical information about what is happening to your website, who is visiting, doing what, downloading what, carrying out business on the website if you are selling something, and so on. And, of course, again, here is a question of sites having massive amounts of data behind them. And, of course, if you want to do this in something near real time, it means that you need to have very powerful tools to work this data here. You need also to have advanced analytical tools to figure out the patterns which are prevalent on the websites and to make use of these things. What I'm describing here are opportunities for our soft computing methods. These are areas where we need to start paying attention, where we should make ourselves visible, and where we should make the technology that we have been developing over the last 50 years, we should start making this technology visible. Informs was first not very supportive of analytics. It was regarded as a competing effort with management science operations research, but very quickly they recognized that the big data challenge is where analytics needs to be. They also very quickly, in typical American fashion, recognized that this is a multi-billion dollar industry. So Informs moved very quickly to embrace analytics and to make it part of the movement. What is done, you can find from the blog. This is Harvard Business Review blog, and this is now a description of where they believe that analytics will be moving in the business community to offer possibilities to deal with the big data challenges. The Sloan Management Review, together with IBM, has also described the new intelligent enterprise, and what they came up with are a number of things. Analytics is a differentiator between successful and less successful companies. There are three levels of capabilities that you can talk about, and these capabilities are, of course, a function of the capabilities that you have in your personnel to deal with the big data challenges, that they have the technical capabilities to do it, they have the knowledge and the training to do it, and they have the motivation to do it. Data is not the biggest obstacle. The resistance to change is the biggest obstacle for this to move. The information that is produced in a company and that is the basis for decision making, that information must be easier to handle, to understand, and to act upon. Leaders can make analytics pay off. The employees cannot do it by themselves. The business leaders need to focus on analytics and need to sponsor the introduction of analytics. There are some recommendations. You need to go for the highest and biggest value opportunities as the first movement. You need to create the success stories where it pays the most. For every opportunity, you have to start with questions and not with the data. And that's a typical problem when you have big data, that you start dealing with the data first and try to figure out what you can find from the data. That's not the way to do it, according to what Sloan Management Review found. They said you need to start with the questions and not with the data. You need to embed insights to drive action. So analytics will give you insight, and then you use that to drive action. You need to have the capabilities of the organization in place. When you work with analytical methods to create new capabilities for the organization, and you need to have an information agenda to plan for the future of the use of analytics in the company. So that was analytics very quickly sketched. And now we have soft computing as it was defined by the European Center for Soft Computing. So here is simply said that this is artificial intelligence research, which is on the design of intelligent systems, which will process uncertain, imprecise, and incomplete information. It is focused on real-world problems. So this is why I want to stress the real-world problem solving. We actually want to work with things which make sense in the real world. And we need to remember that soft computing was introduced by Lotfi Sadek in 1991. And he, from the very beginning, he actually said that, remember now that we should make fuzzy logic, fuzzy optimization, fuzzy theory visible in the real world. Soft computing is a good way to do it. And at the same time, he said that soft computing typically is about fuzzy logic, neural networks, evolutionary computing, and probabilistic reasoning. And this has at then at a later point of time, about 5-6 years ago, been taken over by computational intelligence as a focus area. computational intelligence is a bit more, of course, than soft computing, but the core is now the core of computational intelligence. So this is lots of various types of problems that we have been dealing with at European Center for Soft Computing, and you can see again that we are talking about really practical problems in real industry cases, in society, in business. So again, we are focused on doing real things in the real world, like analytics. And this is why I see that now we can combine soft computing and analytics as movements that can go hand in hand. So let me show you a couple of things where we have tried to follow this recipe. Some of you probably recognize a blast furnace. So this is a blast furnace. We were working with this one in Rahe in northern Finland. It's owned by Rautaruukki, which is the steel producer in Finland. A blast furnace is a rather interesting thing. The core here is so hot, 1,200 centigrades, that no measurement is possible. So whatever technology you want to put in here, it will simply melt. So a blast furnace works that you put in coke and burden, iron ore, layer by layer here in the top, and then it will slowly go down here, and then it melts, and then at the end out you get liquid iron, liquid slag, and you had also to put in some oxygen, nitrogen, moisture, coal, oil, or gas in here to support the process. So now they wanted to find out what is happening here. And that's, of course, a good point. What is happening in here? You cannot measure anything because it will melt. So what you do is that you put sensor systems on the outside of the blast furnace. And then you start measuring the smoke gases going through here. And from the smoke gases, you can then start to make some conclusions about what is the state of the process, how well is it working. And then, of course, you can put some measurement on the liquid iron coming out here and check the quality of the iron coming out. And then you can make some conclusions that the layers of coke and iron ore, that somehow the layers were not properly positioned here. So that had some effect on the liquid iron. But it's not much you can do. You can simply just follow, and then you see that things are happening in the furnace. So now they decided that, okay, let's see if we can figure out something by checking out the smoke gases coming out, because the smoke gases can be actually measured and analyzed through the sensor systems. Problem is here. Yes, you can collect all that data. And what they did was that they collected this data at minute intervals throughout the year. So you get lots of data points. And actually, so many data points that now you see the first dilemma of big data. Just by looking at it, you see, yes, things are happening there. And that's about the only thing you can say, things are happening. What we did first, we simply put the time series analysis here. We used part of the data for training purposes, and then we used part of the data for testing purposes. And you can see that if you put time series models to work on the data, you can gradually, by careful calibration, careful analysis, careful adjusting, you can actually get the time series model to fit the observations pretty nicely. But then when you generate it for the rest of the test data, still you don't seem to be able to fit it very well to the test data. So the first thing we did with all those observations was that we asked ourselves, we can actually follow this minute by minute. Is that making sense? Is it making sense to follow minute by minute? And the answer is no. Because things happening here takes about 8 to 12 hours. So if you do it minute by minute, of course you have lots of data, but it's not meaningful. So the sense-making question is the critical issue, the first critical issue with big data. So after talking to some of the specialists in the field, and these are in abundance, it turns out that you measure it by the hour. So whatever happens here, you put in something here up here, you see the consequences down here after 8 to 12 hours. So it does not make sense to do this with any more frequency than 1 hour. Okay? So then we figured out that there is something else that would make sense. And it turns out, and here is one of the real experts. He has been working with the blast furnace for 12 years. And he said, well, you know, if you really want to make sense of what is happening in the furnace, us experts, we normally check out this one. So this is called gas utilization, the gas utilization. How much of the carbon monoxide is turned into carbon dioxide in the process. And this one shows something about the quality of the process. So he said, this is the one we follow. Then we asked him why. And he said, I don't know. But it seems to work out. So over the years, we have been following this one, and we have been able to see that there is some matching between this gas utilization and the quality of the iron coming out. So fine. Here we have another thing, which is pointing to the fact that if you want to deal with big data, try to find the core logic of the processes that is generating the data. And here we had a partial answer. Look at these things. Okay, so that's then a good point. Then we started shopping around for good time series models. We started with the classical ARMA model, or the ARIMA model, the autoregressive moving average integrated time series model. And it turns out after testing that that is not working. So it makes no sense with the blast furnace time series data. You cannot really capture anything there. Then we shopped around a bit more, and we came up with the adaptive neurofuzzy inference system, which is a rather new one. It's been around for about 10, 15 years. And it looks like this. So we have layers of where we adapt the system to the data. And these layers are trained again and again up to 10,000 iterations so that we can fine-tune the model to the observations that we use as a training set. And this now follows a very old principle that is well-known from cybernetics. It's called requisite variety. So if you want to deal with something which is very complex, very dynamic, almost chaotic, try to come up with tools, instruments, models that have the requisite variety that they can match the things that you are working on. And that's the third principle for dealing with big data. So come up with the tools that can match the complexity of the data sets that you have. We tested the ANFIS method, and the ANFIS method appears to have the requisite variety, at least to a certain extent, so much that it can actually start matching the variations we had. Okay? And then the fourth principle, find out if there are effective variables or if there are variables creating the data, driving the data set, which simply contribute to the amount of data but does not contribute to the actual process. And the technique is well known. It's called principal component analysis. So run through the data sets with that and figure out what are the actual variables that have some relevance for the processes that we want to study. And it turns out that here are the variables which have an impact on the iron quality and the running of the blast furnace. And see here the time lags. So the time lags are not the expected 8 hours. There are less, 2 and 3 and 4 hours. And there are some which are even longer than the expected 8 hours, 10 and 14 hours. So principal component analysis or similar statistical techniques are very useful when you try to reduce the complexity in a big data set. Then we started to work out various combinations here. So we simply tried to see if there are any patterns that we can work on in the time series. And as you can see, there are all kinds of strange variations coming in here for purposes that were not well understood. But there is no real good pattern that you can find here. So then came the fifth step, talk to the experts, and the experts said that in a blast furnace, there might be something going wrong. So then what you do is that you take out all the data 8 hours after the moment when something went wrong, and you take out all the data 8 hours before that moment. Because that's something which is not typical for the blast furnace. It was something going wrong. So you should not train your data based on those observations. And then the last point by the experts was take out all the outliers. If you are not experienced with the process itself, you try to also capture all the outliers. And that's not a good idea if you want to find the patterns in the actual process. So here is the ANFIS final results. And you can see that we managed to get very, very small mean square errors in the training data set. And we were able to fit that model pretty well. And then we were running it against, again, a test data set. The test data set had some problems, as you can see. These are the original data, so here the outliers are not taken away. And we have not cleaned it up in such a way as we did with the test data set. So again, even if the test data set is pretty well matched, still we have challenges when we move over to the validation. So this was the ANFIS, and ANFIS was doing pretty well. Actually, in a comparison with several other time series methods, this is now the champion we have at the moment. But you can see from this operation that it is rather a challenge to get to deal with these large data sets. So at some point 5 years ago, we thought it was a blessing if we can get lots of data. Today, we realize it's not a blessing. It's much more of a challenge to deal with big data. Here's another one. And this has to do with something which is rather interesting. It's pumps. These pumps are intelligent pumps these days, something which was rather new to me. That they actually decide what is going through them, how much is going through them, and when things are going through them. So these are pretty autonomous decision makers in industrial processes. The pumps have valves in them, and these valves, to the valves, things happen from time to time. So the thing here is that we started looking into this. This is part of an industrial research program called Data to Intelligence. And we started looking into this possibility to come to terms with the valves. So valves are inside the pump, and from time to time, they either malfunction, or they partially malfunction, or nothing happened to them. They simply go on working again and again and again for hours, days, months, years after years. The problem with the valves is that some of them fail at random intervals. Some of them do not fail. So you cannot actually put together a good maintenance policy for the valves to say that, okay, replace all the valves every 8 months, and that's it, and you don't worry about it. Turns out that if you have a process industry with about 10,000 pumps, you have about 50,000 valves there. So it makes no sense to always replace the valves. So here is now a focus on this problem, which is said that there is some trade-off between the maintenance cost and the penalty cost for having a valve failure in a pump. And the situation is rather nicely identified in this setup here. So situation that faces the decision makers is that they can actually transfer the risk. So they say, valves, that's not our business. We make a contract with somebody, a third party. It's called hedging in our world. And this third party take responsibility for the maintenance, for when to do the maintenance, and they charge us some cost for doing that. So we do a risk transfer, and we don't worry about it anymore. And that might make sense if the actual cost for doing that is not very, very high. Then you avoid, try to avoid the risk. So don't take the risk. Here is actually said, allow the competitor to take the business. Well, it's not a very attractive proposition for most industrial partners to say this, but of course that is an alternative. So you say that the cost and the risk with this one is too high, so my worst competitor, you are welcome to this business. And then you look at them and see them fail and enjoy life. Then you can, of course, minimize risk, and that is to have maintenance at regular intervals and replace valves and avoid having the situation that they fail and that things happen to your pumps. Always when you do that, there is this annual review meeting where somebody says, well, this is costing lots of money. Are you sure that that was the best policy? And then you do risk acceptance. You say, okay, fine. Valves fail. That will cost me some money. That's okay. The money is not too much, then okay, I take the risk. This is a rather interesting situation. We have been doing this work previously with grid computing, and we were talking with industrial partners where they have a grid. They had 1,200 processors in the grid, and original academic assumption was that you cannot fail in grid computing. So we were working to very close specifications. We said that the risk of failure cannot be more than 4%. And then we worked out very precise models. After 12 months, when we started presenting that to the industrial partner, they said that's too expensive. That we cannot actually pay for having that low risk. And we asked them, guys, what is a reasonable risk level that you accept? They say 15%. So it's a totally different world that you look at if you have a risk acceptance of 15% versus 4%. The way you approach the whole problem is very different. So the risk avoidance, risk reduction, you do it at 4%, you spend much more money than if you do it at 15%. So we had to revise everything that we were doing because we had the wrong assumption. Okay, so here we go, big data again. Here we have now collected data. We have 500 data columns. This is an Excel spreadsheet, simply. And we have historical data over the valves in one certain pump. So I said we have about 10,000 different pumps. But here is one pump, and for that we collected all this data. And now what happens to the valve, that is called an incident, and we want to figure out that if we have the historical data available, what is the probability that we have an incident with a valve in the next time period, two time periods, three time periods, four time periods, and so on. And of course, when you hear things like that, you start thinking that this is probably base probabilities. Okay, so we did one attempt with base predictive probabilities. And then we figured out that this is really heavy computation to do it. So we started looking into the possibility to replace the base probabilities with possibility theory. And we actually built a hybrid possibilistic Bayesian model to work with the same data. Because we figured out that this is computationally less cumbersome, takes less resources than doing the base probabilities. So the actual solution here is a fuzzy non-parametric regression model. I will not go into details on that one, but just to let you know that that type of modeling was done here. Here is the base probabilities, and you probably recognize the way to do it. So here is the Bayes' theorem, where you simply go and check what is the history about the valves. And typically, the incident follows a Poisson process, and the frequency of the arrival of the incident follows a Poisson distribution. And then it's well known in statistics that the best way to do this is through a gamma distribution, and then the predictive probabilities can be calculated from a Poisson gamma predictive distribution. So that's classical things. It's been around for 50, 60 years, and nothing much to it. So the process is very straightforward. The only thing was that we wanted to do this with fuzzy numbers. Okay, in this group, there is no sense in going through fuzzy numbers. You know them very well. So that was what we did. And then we started to do the fuzzy non-parametric regression model and using the triangular fuzzy numbers in that model. And it's very straightforward. The only thing we need to do is that we look through the historical data, and then we do predictions, and then we have a deviation, and then we use that deviation as a distance measure, a square distance measure, and then we have to minimize the distances. The thing that we actually used here was the diamond distance measure, but the nice thing here was that we were able to find a good way to approximate the Bayes model. This is simply a learning process with the model to find out that we can get a good approximation from the time series. So this is how it was done. Here is some test results from a similar case study. Now we are not allowed to show the valves because that's industrial information, and we are not allowed to show how that works with pumps. So we have to resort to an other example that we have been testing with the same models. And this is now from the grid computing. This is the Los Alamos grid, where they had 1,200 processors working. They collected data for 11 years. And yes, they collected it every second. So, of course, that's a very good data set. And we have been working with it. We did the base probabilities, and we did this hybrid model. And here are four different scenarios of how somebody wants to operate the grid. So they have, for instance, here a cluster of 150 processors, and they will have 100 computing tasks. And then for various time periods, it went actually from 1 hour up to 14 days. So there are heavy-duty computing when you run 14 days on 150 processors and you run something about 100 computing tasks in parallel. So you can imagine that during that time something may happen to the processors. One of them fail, and in the worst case scenario, the computing task fails. And of course, if you follow the laws of statistics, it fails during the last hour of the 14 days. So that's what you have to live with. But you want to figure out what is the probability that this will happen. So we did that with the base modeling. And a very typical thing here is that here is now a test run with 4.9 days, computational tasks. And the typical thing is that one of the processors fail. It's more common that one processor fails than that zero processors fail. And then the thing goes down very, very quickly. So here you see the number of crashes during the time intervals that we were studying. And you see that there are variations here that are hard to predict. So you normally think that when you work with grid computing that these are mechanical things. So if they fail, they follow certain laws of statistics. Well, it appears that they don't. We had in the material, we had processors which had run for 11 years without failing even once. We had processors that had been through regular maintenance every 12 months, came out of the maintenance, and the next day it failed. So there is no real cause-effect relationships here. It appears to be a rather random process. So the Poisson assumption was pretty good here. And we run this again and again on all kinds of scenarios, and it seems that this idea that this is the core logic behind everything in grid computing, that still is a good idea. So this is what we were hunting for, find the core logic from all that data. And here we have it with a very classical approach. Then we did something else. We said, okay, the hybrid model here would allow us not to run the 11 years, but you can do the last 2 years, and then you do repeated sampling thousands of times. And the question was, will this possibilistic model be a good approximation of the base model? And the answer is yes. So now it turns out that instead of running through huge data sets, you can actually do sampling and do repeated sampling of much smaller data set. And you find something which is a close match to the classical approach. And this again was now an example that I said the risk acceptance was 4% in our estimate. The actual acceptance was 15%, and that these things are not so closely related in industrial and business practice that has no relevance. So they said basically that if you can do this in almost real time and do fast sampling and come up with a good approximation, which will show us what is the possibility that the processors will go down when we run a heavy-duty computing task. That's fine. We accept that this is not precise, and we accept that there is a certain risk here, but 15% is quite acceptable. You cannot be in business if you are more risk-adverse than 15%, as a rule of thumb. So again, this was a good example of what Lotfi Saari has said. At some point of time, there is a trade-off between precision and relevance. You cannot get more relevance without giving up on precision. And you cannot get more precision without giving up on relevance. And this is a very typical example where that principle works very well. So there is also a difference between us as academics and researchers. When we report for the journals, they typically would not accept this type of reasoning, that yes, you do it very approximately, and yes, it appears pretty good. No, they want to have precision. They want to us to show precisely how this is working out. They want this approach is much more liked by the journals than this approach. And I think that in the world of big data, we have to start changing our ways, especially in the journals, that relevance is actually more important than precision. Well, that is against lots of principles in scientific research. So this was a very interesting experiment that we carried out. And then we have been doing some fun here. And that was divine ontology. Now working with industrial processes, again, we have an industrial process in the background, which we cannot publish because we have strategic information in there. So instead we took the whole technology, and then we started testing it on material that we can publish. So here we have now collected 680 wines, various kinds, Spanish, Italian, French, some Californian, some Australian. We were forced to do that. Figured out how would various wines fit into various drinking scenarios. So a drinking scenario is one where you have one drinker who is a connoisseur or not a very interested wine drinker. We have a whole variation of these things. And if the occasion is a question of having a formal dinner, dinner with friends, candlelight dinner, picnic, and so on, so various variations of the setup where you can drink wine. We also have more sophisticated features here. We have the food that you are going to have. We have the spices that you will have with the food. We have also consider now the variation that you have a three-course dinner with three different types of wine. So how do you match the wines when you have a three-wine dinner? Which is turned out when we started looking into it, rather advanced knowledge. It's not something you can explain in less than 12 hours. So that is an ontology which is describing what is the best wine to combine with what food, and what context and what situation. And this had some rather interesting things. First of all, when you start doing the ontology, you go for something which is fitting into the semantic web. Semantic web, as you know, is based on a classic ontology. 2004, when Tim Berners-Lee got the first Millennium Prize, there was a workshop in Helsinki where his team was visiting, and they were talking about having the semantic web up and running by 2007 and connecting everything on the World Wide Web. And we told them, there was a whole group of people, mostly soft computing people there, we told them, guys, if you really want this to work, think about having a fuzzy ontology. And they said, no, that will not happen. And we asked them, why? They said, Tim Berners-Lee was in an interview after some hard discussions, and then he said, there will never be fuzzy logic in semantic web. And as you know, these are famous last words, because semantic web is not operating yet, and we have 2013. So we tried to explain that you could actually put in a fuzzy description logic there, and they said, the World Wide Web Consortium said, no, will not happen. But then we have a good friend, Umberto Straccia, University of Pisa. He's actually a member of World Wide Web Consortium. So he wrote a fuzzy description logic that would fit the semantic web. And then he was really smart. He took out the ontology web language, and he wrote the whole thing in ontology web language, so it already matches the standard of semantic web. And now he has produced a plugin, which is actually writing fuzzy ontology in OWL script. So we have been using that one, and it's a good way to represent fuzzy descriptions in semantic web script. And then you need a platform to test these things on, and that's Protégé. Protégé is open source, and it's actually done for building ontologies and testing them. And here we put the fuzzy OWL plugin on the Protégé, and we have been able to create a wine ontology, which is now actually a fuzzy ontology. Looks like this. So it's a very nice graphical interface. So here you see wines of various kinds with everything that you need to describe the wines. Here you see a trapezoidal fuzzy description of the qualities of the wine. So we use this representation for all the wines here. Actually putting 680 wines in this form was not a big deal. This is why you have doctoral students. So they spent about a week, and they did it. And of course, they said that they need to taste all the 680 wines, but I could not give them the budget to do that, even if the empirical study made lots of sense. So in Protégé, it looks like this when you put in the wine descriptions. And here you get the ontology web language code, which is automatically generated from Protégé. So you don't have to do this. For our wine ontology, now we have put in something. I think we have complete descriptions of about 100 wines, and that's this is a few thousand lines of code that we have in the ontology web language. Then, of course, here you see the structure. What you need to do is you need to have a Gurobe optimizer in order to do part of the descriptions that you have to do with Java. And then you have to get space on the GlassFish server to run everything. And this is what you can do as an academic research group. You can get access to all these resources. If you are a company and you want to do the same thing, they start talking serious money for giving you these resources. But it's not prohibitive in any way. You talk cloud applications in order to put this architecture together. So it is actually a very viable approach. And then here you see the FuzzyDL code, description logic code, also generated by now the Stracha plugin, so you don't have to write these things. And the only thing you need to write is the Java part, and that's only now for each scenario about 10-15 lines of code, so it's not that bad. And we have only about 25 different scenarios at this moment. So in a sense, what I've been describing here is simply that, okay, here is the semantic web. They've been trying to cover the whole world, the whole globe, everything which is known on the globe with a classical ontology. And we said, this is not doable. And looky here, just a few guys sitting down for a while, having some fun with friends from Italy. We actually have also some friends from Granada who come. At the moment, we have one guy from Granada working with us. They want actually to build this wine ontology, so they come and spend the summer in Finland to do it. So here is now version number 3 of the ontology at the moment, and you simply pick up here that what is the context. This is kind of like dinner. What is the food? It's game. And then how many people are going to be with you? If you have kind of like typically only one more. So that was an easy thing, and then you get a ranking of the most suitable wines for this occasion. Now you see the server where we have the whole thing. Now our Granada friends came up with this thing that, of course, if you are more than two people at the table. Also, if you are only two people, it might come to this discussion. Which wine is better of certain combinations of possibilities? Typically, if you have five people at the table, you get lots of discussion. People have various types of preferences. Yes, we have been testing Fuzzy AHP as one of the algorithms behind this one. And then this is a nice thing you can do there. While you discuss the wine list, that who is preferring what wine and how much ahead of another wine. And this is something which is happening on a smartphone, an Android smartphone, so you can actually do it as a group when you are in the restaurant. There are all kinds of things here. Smartphone means that you can also have the possibility that you enter the restaurant, the smartphone gets an update on the available wines from the restaurant, so that you don't have lots of argument about wines that you can never get at the restaurant, which is kind of silly. So that's you get an update of the active wine list they have. And then you get a ranking, and the ranking will then say show the consensus and the degree of consensus. And you can see here it was extremely high. And then when you see the results, you can do a number of things. You can vote again because you think the extremely high consensus is not enough. Or you can order the selected wine, which is now this one. Anybody recognizes this wine? Anybody's favorite? I don't know. I never drink any of these wines. They are too expensive. But this is how it works out, and you can see this is branching out to all kinds of applications. Okay, so let me just summarize. The idea is to use analytics to find core logic and effective variables. So you don't go with brute force, cloud computing, architectures, and whatever you have, and run the big data sets. You try to use smartness to find out core logic and effective variables first. Then you develop the methods that you need to deal with complexity. And of course, most of the algorithms that we have heard during the presentations today, they apply to this to work out the complexity, to deal with the complexity. I was calling this creating requisite variety, so that you have tools which are powerful enough to cope with the complexity that you have in your actual problem solving. Here I put Lotfi Saari's reminder that there is a trade-off between precision and relevance. And I think that's the driving force behind the combination of analytics and soft computing. And I think that soft computing today have enough precision to tackle complex problems. We have families of algorithms that are simpler, faster, and more robust than classical algorithms. We have algorithms that can scale up when the problem keeps growing. And this scaling up is something that you encounter all the time in industrial processes. Remember that about 4 or 5 years ago, people upgraded the computing resources because they said, we need more computing power because the data is growing so fast. Guess what happened? The data was growing even faster after they upgraded the computing resources. So we are not actually solving the problems this way. Okay, thank you very much.